Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. As promised on the last occasion, when we had a lecture devoted to the what might be called the political science aspects of the Republic question, this lecture is going to be devoted to the constitutional aspects of it. And there's no shortage of people who are experts on Commonwealth Constitution. The place could be carpeted with them. But people who know something about state constitutions are much rarer, and the state constitutions are something that is a secret garden to most of us. However, we have here today, I can safely say, Australia's leading expert on state constitutions, Dr. Anne Toomey, and she's going to bring that expertise to bear on the relevance to the Commonwealth Constitution. Please welcome her to the podium.
Thank you very much, Harry. The question of whether Australia should become a republic will no doubt, sooner or later, come to the forefront of public debate again. Now, this is not an issue that I intend to address today. And for those of you who are disappointed and want to run for the door, you can do so now. Instead, I've been asked to speak about the constitutional issues concerning transformation to a republic. Now, many of those were thrashed out earlier, prior to the 1999 republic referendum. However, the loss of that referendum pushed the public debate towards consideration of a directly elected head of state. Opinion polls, as John Warhurst said in the previous lecture here, opinion polls have consistently shown that of all the Republican models, Australians would prefer a directly elected head of state. And the Labor Party's platform also states that Labor will conduct plebiscites to establish support for an Australian head of state and the preferences of the Australian people for different models of a republic. Now, all these factors suggest that when the republic next rises up the political agenda, it will involve some form of a direct election model, or at least that will be what's on the table. Now, this means that new and much broader constitutional issues will need to be grappled with than those that were considered previously in relation to the 1999 model, and it's those different constitutional issues that I propose to address today. Now, personally, while I understand the attraction in having a say in who is our head of state, I personally can't see the value of directly electing a head of state. First of all, the types of people who would make a good head of state are extremely unlikely to stand for election. Secondly, it's likely that only political parties or the very rich would have the money to run a national election campaign, and that would reduce the choices for head of state. But thirdly, and this is something that's often played on my mind, one really must wonder on what basis a person would campaign to be a Republican head of state in Australia. I mean, what would you actually say in your campaign speech? Would you say, vote for me because I behave well at funerals? Would you say, vote for me because I know which knife and fork to use at dinner parties and I can negotiate a cocktail party without spilling food down my shirt? Or would you say, vote for me because I have superior ribbon-cutting skills and I don't fall asleep while watching handkerchief dancing or listening to interminable speeches? All of these being very necessary skills for a head of state. Now, I've been recently reading the private letters of Sir Philip Game, who was Governor of New South Wales in the early 1930s. This is for a book that's being written on the governors of New South Wales. After being in the job for about 6 months, Sir Philip wrote to his mother-in-law back in England and said that the two great skills needed to be governor were the ability to give a speech at the drop of a hat on a subject about which you know absolutely nothing, and also the ability to eat enormous meal after meal at official functions at all hours of the day and night. Now, he claimed that he had become an expert at being able to hide food on his plate without it being obvious at these dinners, and he wrote to his mother-in-law and said, I have not yet had to put the scraps of food in my pockets, but you never know what it may come to. So perhaps the best claim for being head of state would be having the gift of the gab and the gob. As Sir Philip Game later discovered, in some cases a governor needs skills such as knowledge and other skills such as the knowledge and the experience to deal with constitutional crises. Engulfed in the global financial crisis, which was the Great Depression, and faced with an unorthodox and intransigent premier in Jack Lang, Sir Philip Game lamented in his letters home that he was not an economist or a constitutional lawyer, and he thought he did not have the necessary knowledge or experience to perform his role adequately. Perhaps today we would see candidates for the head of state claiming that they had the answers to our economic woes or superior knowledge about the reserve powers. Indeed, it could be a new niche market for constitutional lawyers, which perhaps wouldn't be such a bad thing, but somehow I doubt it. It seems to me inevitable that those campaigning to be elected head of state would instead focus on political matters. Perhaps they would claim to be the champion of the underdog, to represent the views of rural Australians or Indigenous Australians or battlers or whatever you want to call them today. It's likely that some candidates would go further than that. They would campaign on particular issues, nuclear energy, for or against, climate change, a Bill of Rights, end to Australian involvement in a controversial war. They may even go so far as promising to refuse assent to a particularly controversial bill or to direct the armed forces not to fight in an unpopular war or even give an election promise to dismiss a government. Ultimately, it would be irresponsible to set up a directly elected head of state with a popular mandate as a rival to the Prime Minister. It would be a recipe for future constitutional crises. And that is why any proposal for a directly elected head of state would require the imposition of significant limitations on the powers of the head of state. Now, one way of dealing with this problem is by codifying the reserve powers of the head of state. And this would remove the head of state's discretion and set down rules by which his or her powers would have to be exercised. Attempts at codifying the reserve powers were made by the Constitutional Conventions of the 1970s and the Constitutional Commission's Advisory Committee on Executive Power in 1987, although an absolute consensus remained elusive. The Republic Advisory Committee also addressed the subject in some detail in 1993, but the matter went no further. The problem with complete codification, however, is that while it gives certainty, it also imposes inflexibility. It is impossible now to imagine every circumstance that might arise in the future where flexibility is needed. The risk with complete codification is that the rules it imposes might prove not only inappropriate, but damaging in future circumstances. The genius of our current system is that it has allowed the executive to grow from being a dependent colonial administration to the government of an independent nation without the need for formal constitutional change. Uncertainty about the rules has the benefit that few have been prepared to provoke conflicts that would push the rules to their limits, as nobody knows what the limits of those rules might be. It's therefore wise to continue to permit at least some degree of flexibility and discretion to allow for unforeseen circumstances and for future growth. There is, however, an alternative way of approaching the problem. Now, back in the 1980s, when the Australia Acts were being negotiated, the states found that they were having some deal of difficulty in convincing the Queen that she should be directly advised by state ministers with respect to state matters. Now, as I mentioned in a previous lecture here, Her Majesty had met Joe Bjelke-Petersen, seemed to take the view that state premiers were all a bit mad, and wasn't prepared to be advised by them at all. Formally, though, in stating her concerns, she said that she was concerned that she would receive conflicting advice from different sets of ministers. So she'd have a state advising her to say or do one thing, and she'd have the Commonwealth advising her to say or do something else. And that's obviously an inherent problem for Her Majesty. Instead of trying to codify the questions of who would advise the Queen on particular issues, the states decided that it would be more sensible to remove or delegate most of the Queen's powers so that the question of who advised her would only arise in two very limited cases, namely the appointment and removal of the state governor. powers with respect to the granting of assent to reserve bills and to disallowance of laws were removed by the Australia Acts. So there was no question of conflicting advice in relation to them. And other powers that were formally exercised by the Queen were delegated to the Governor, except for when the Queen was personally present in the state. Now, by reducing the field of potential conflict, concerns over how the remaining powers were exercised were also reduced. The Queen was eventually satisfied, and the Australia Acts in 1986 were passed. Now, a similar approach could be taken with respect to the powers of a head of state if Australia were to become a republic. By eliminating many of the most controversial circumstances in which those powers might otherwise be exercised, the powers of the head of state would be much more confined. But a degree of flexibility would still be retained to deal with unforeseen circumstances. Now, examples of this approach can be found in the Australian states, where the governors, in most cases, have a much more limited discretion than the Governor General does at the national level. The greatest controversies concerning the exercise of discretionary power by viceregal representatives in Australia have concerned the grant or the refusal of a dissolution and the dismissal of a government followed by a dissolution. The dismissal of the Lang government by Sir Philip Game in 1932 and the Whitlam government in 1975 come most readily to mind, but there have been other cases where a governor has had to demand the resignation of a premier, or at least encourage it, and they include cases such as in Victoria in 1952. There are also numerous examples of viceregal representatives refusing a premier's advice to grant a dissolution when a government has lost the confidence of the lower house or could not obtain supply, including three examples at the Commonwealth level in 1904, 1905, and 1909. And in the states, and I say here at least because we can never actually get a final figure on this because it may well be that these things happened in private and never became public, but in trying to tally these up, I found at least seven cases of refusals of dissolution in New South Wales, one in Queensland, two in South Australia, four in Tasmania, one in Western Australia, and a grand total of 10 in Victoria, which wins the prize for political instability up until the 1950s. Most of those cases arose before the political party system became stable, when there were shifting majorities and governments not infrequently lost power through no confidence motions. However, the discretion to refuse an early dissolution still remains. In New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria, however, the powers of the governor with respect to dissolutions and dismissals have been significantly limited in scope because of the introduction of fixed four-year terms. In these states, the election date is now fixed by the Constitution. Now, this largely eliminates the governor's discretion to grant or refuse a dissolution. Specific exceptions are provided for. So, for example, there's a mechanism for changing the date of a state election if it clashes with another event, like Easter, or it's not possible to hold an election because of a natural catastrophe like floods, or for some other reason. More importantly, if a vote of no confidence in the government is passed by the Assembly, and within a specified period there has been no vote of confidence back in that government, there's usually a period allowed for in case a government loses a vote of no confidence just through an accident of someone not being there or available at that time. So there's usually an extra period of grace for confidence to be restored if that's the case. But if a vote of no confidence is passed in the government, in the lower house, and within that specified period there's no vote of confidence in the government, then the Assembly may be dissolved by the Governor before the four-year term expires. That's the system in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia. The Governor cannot dissolve the Assembly on this particular ground unless the precise terms of this exception are met. So there has to be notice before the no confidence motion is given, there has to be the period after and all the rest of it. You have to meet the exact terms of it. But if you do meet those exact terms, then the Governor appears to retain a discretion as to whether or not to grant the dissolution. Now, that is because it may be the case that a new government can be commissioned and govern until the next scheduled election without there being a need for an election. So, for example, where majorities change in the lower house, maybe a different coalition has arisen and now there is a government that does have a majority in the lower house that can continue to govern. In New South Wales, the provisions actually give some direction to the governor as to what matters he or she must take into account in exercising this discretion, and that includes whether the Legislative Assembly has expressed confidence in an alternative government. So if the lower house not only passes a motion of no confidence in the government, but also says, and we have confidence in someone else to form a government, then that's something that the governor has to take into account in deciding whether to opt for a dissolution, so an early election, or whether to commission a new premier to run the government for the rest of the four-year term. In New South Wales, there's an additional ground that may trigger an early dissolution, and that's the rejection or delay of the grant of supply by the lower house, the Legislative Assembly. Neither the South Australian nor the Victorian constitutions contain this exception, but presumably if the Legislative Assembly is prepared to reject supply, this would normally amount to an implied vote of no confidence in the government anyway, and so one would imagine in those circumstances a formal vote of no confidence would also be passed, so it's probably not an issue. The Victorian and South Australian constitutions also contain further exceptions that permit the governor to dissolve the assembly before its four-year term expires where there are deadlocked bills. South Australia is actually the more interesting on these. It has two such exceptions. The first one deals with bills that are declared by the House of Assembly to be bills of special importance. If they are not passed within 2 months by the Legislative Council, then they become triggers for an early election. However, they cannot be stockpiled, unlike the bills that are stockpiled in the Commonwealth Parliament as Section 57 double dissolution triggers that can be used at any date. In this case, in South Australia, that trigger for an early election only lasts for a period of 1 month after the bill didn't get through the upper house. If it's not exercised within that power, within that time, then the trigger expires. The other South Australian exception is its double dissolution procedure, which involves bills being passed by the Assembly and then rejected by the Legislative Council in two successive parliaments. So you have to have an election in between. And then you can get a double dissolution, and that double dissolution is again permitted as an early election. Outside these express exceptions, the Victorian and the South Australian governors have no power to dissolve the Legislative Assembly. So to that extent, the reserve power there has been completely removed. In New South Wales, deadlocked bills are dealt with by a different mechanism. They're dealt with by holding a referendum on the bills concerned rather than an early election. So that's an alternative way of dealing with the issue. However, in New South Wales, there's also an extraordinarily inadequate provision which purports to preserve some of the reserve powers of the governor. Section 24B5 of the New South Wales Constitution provides that the governor is not prohibited from dissolving the Legislative Assembly early in circumstances other than those mentioned in the provision, so in circumstances other than those concerning a loss of confidence in the lower house, which is dealt with by those specific provisions. So despite any advice of the Premier or the Executive Council, if the governor could do so in accordance with established constitutional conventions. Now, I gather that the idea here was to preserve to some extent a reserve power on the part of the governor to force a dissolution. Unfortunately, it's an extremely badly worded provision because it doesn't work. It's always preferable not to have provisions in your constitution that don't work, but this is one of them. The problem here is that the governor has never had a power to dissolve the Legislative Assembly without advice. Now, what normally happens, and when I say normally, it's quite extraordinarily, but if a governor dismisses a government, such as the governor of New South Wales did with the Lang government in 1932, then what happens is that the governor then appoints a new person to be premier, and then that person then advises the governor to hold the election. So the governor always acts on advice in terms of the holding of the election, and the way the election is forced is by changing your advisor. So the problem here is that the New South Wales Constitution happily says that the governor retains these reserve powers to force a dissolution, contrary to the advice of the governor's advisers, according to established constitutional conventions, and there is none. So it doesn't work, basically. And this is probably the reason why no other jurisdiction has copied it. Because you see with a lot of these provisions, the New South Wales provisions formed a model for the other states, but no one was going anywhere near that one. So if the governor of Victoria or South Australia or New South Wales decides to dismiss a government by withdrawing the commission of the premier and appointing a new premier who did not hold the confidence of the lower house, then the governor could not dissolve the assembly on the advice of that new premier. Slight problem. But if that new premier did not hold the confidence of the lower house, then one would expect there would be a vote of no confidence in the premier and the government in the lower house, and then that would lead to an election. So it's a bit more of a convoluted process. You'll get there in the end, because it would seem extraordinary for a lower house not to pass a vote of no confidence in the newly appointed government after the dismissal of the previous government. So it's likely to work that way, but it would be a slower process. It wouldn't be as neat and clean as the dismissals in 1975 and 1932. So these provisions do not work perfectly, but they show that there are ways in which the Constitution can regulate events so that they do not result in circumstances where the head of state is placed in the position of having to contemplate the exercise of the reserve powers. If the Commonwealth Constitution provided for fixed four-year terms, with exceptions for an early election in the case of a successful vote in the House of Representatives of no confidence in the government, or possibly deadlocked bills, a double dissolution provision that you've already had, maybe getting rid of the stockpiling aspects of it, or also possibly saying expressly what I think the New South Wales provision was trying to do, saying that dismissal of a government by the head of state would result in a trigger for an early election. You could say that expressly. If you did that, then there would still be a capacity in the head of state to dismiss a government that persisted in illegality, for example, which was the problem back in the Lang era, or that refused to resign after losing an election. So there'd be a small amount of discretion left, but as a general principle, there'd be very little discretion at all. Now, for such provisions to work effectively, one must also deal with the still sensitive issue of the power of the Senate to block supply. It needs to be recognised that in 5 of the 8 state and territory legislatures, there is no possibility of supply being blocked by an upper house. Now, this is because in Queensland, Northern Territory and the ACT, they just don't have an upper house, which avoids the problem. And in New South Wales and Victoria, the Legislative Council cannot effectively block supply. And what I mean there is that in New South Wales and Victoria, the Legislative Council still has the power to reject or suggest amendments to any bill that appropriates money for the ordinary annual services of government, but the Legislative Assembly can just ignore that and present the bill to the Governor for assent without the Legislative Council's agreement. So the bill will still become law, the appropriation is still passed, even though the Legislative Council does not agree to it. If one looks back to the constitutional crises that have occurred in the last 2 centuries in Australia, many have involved a failure to pass supply or problems with deadlocked bills that the upper house has refused to pass. Now, workable deadlock provisions and limits on the power of the upper house to block or unduly delay supply are key factors in avoiding the circumstances in which the head of state might otherwise be called upon to exercise reserve powers. We need to move beyond the rights and the wrongs of what happened in 1975 to consider adopting a system that currently operates uncontroversially at the state and territory level. I say that advisedly, knowing that Harry is sitting beside me, and what I would like to stress is that the loss of the power to block supply does not mean that the Senate in any way needs to be neutered in its effectiveness. despite the fact that in 1933 the New South Wales Legislative Council lost the power to block supply, it has in fact proved to be one of the most powerful and, dare I say, aggressive houses of any parliament in the country. There are far more ways to bring a government to account than threatening to block supply. If one were to go down this route, and I might say that this is an extremely hypothetical route, it's hypothetical based on the fact that there was going to be a republic, there was going to be a directly elected head of state, you needed to reduce the powers of the directly elected head of state, and therefore you went through this process. But if you did get there, an important consideration as part of the quid pro quo would be to increase other powers of the Senate to bring the government into account if one was to remove the power to block supply. Now, it's true that the combination of fixed term parliaments and the loss of the Senate's power to block supply would mean that there would be very limited grounds upon which there could be a change of government between elections. In New South Wales, there have been many recent complaints about being stuck with the government until the next election in 2011. This has resulted in fixed four-year terms receiving some exceedingly bad press of late. However, even if the term is not fixed, an unpopular government is rarely inclined to commit harakiri by going to the polls early, just as it's unlikely in a fixed-term parliament to cause an early election by voting no confidence in itself, or more realistically, as has been done a couple of times in Germany, where they also have the same fixed-term parliament issue, just abstaining from voting when the opposition brings a vote of no confidence in yourself in order to cause an election, which is what happened most recently in Germany in 2005. Nor does the vice-regal representative have the power to dismiss a government just because it's no longer popular or might be considered incompetent or any other grounds of the like. Regardless of whether there are fixed or flexible terms. So the current debate on this issue, particularly with respect to New South Wales, I think is somewhat misconceived. Indeed, there remains a strong trend towards fixed four-year terms in Australia. The Northern Territory has just introduced fixed four-year terms. The ACT already had them. And the Northern Territory adopted the New South Wales approach, except for the bit of it with the silly provision that doesn't work. The Western Australian and the Tasmanian governments have both recently promised to introduce fixed four-year terms as well. They're apparently currently consulting on legislation to do so. And if that goes through, then that only leaves Queensland and the Commonwealth with flexible three-year terms. So it is an interesting trend that's been developing in Australia. If at the Commonwealth level, the Senate could not block supply, preventing a repetition of a 1975-style crisis, and there were fixed electoral terms with provisions for an early election in the case of deadlocked bills or successful votes of no confidence in the House of Representatives, this would eliminate much of the discretion of the head of state, which they would otherwise be able to exercise. Now, apart from dissolutions and dismissals, the other main area in which a level of discretion is exercised by the vice-regal representative is in choosing who to appoint as the Prime Minister or Premier. The convention is that the vice-regal representative appoints as the head of government the person who holds the confidence of the lower house of parliament. Usually the identification of this person is simple and there is no need for any exercise of discretion. However, where there is a hung parliament or a governing coalition breaks up or a governing party splits or the head of government dies or a party loses confidence in their own leader, then these questions sometimes arise. And in Australia, there are examples of all these occurrences. For example, in 1916, when the Labor Party split over conscription, the Labor Premier of New South Wales, William Holman, was abandoned by his party, which then elected a new Labor leader and moved a vote of no confidence in his government. The opposition leader, Charles Wade, then moved an amendment that simply deferred the resolution of no confidence, and said, so, well, we'll just sort of work on, you know, there's a war happening and we won't worry about it. So there was this vote of no confidence sitting there, deferred. You had a premier who was no longer had the support of his own party, and the governor, Sir Gerald Strickland, then concluded that Holman did not have the confidence of the Legislative Assembly and sought his resignation. On that fateful day of the 11th of November, this time in 1916, it's a bad day for politicians, 11th of November, the newspapers declared, quote, "sensational political development, governor dismisses premier." Holman objected that the governor had no grounds to require his resignation as the vote of no confidence had not been passed. It had just been deferred. The governor argued that Holman had been elected as a Labor premier and no longer had the support of the Labor Party and that he should therefore resign. Holman argued that until he was defeated on the floor of the Legislative Assembly, he was not obliged to resign, and the British government agreed and supported that position. The governor was forced to back down. Holman and Wade eventually formed a ministry and continued to govern without an election. Sometimes coalitions break down, leading to difficult decisions for a vice-regal representative. For example, in Victoria in 1935, the United Australia Party and the Country Party campaigned together as a coalition and won the election. However, before Parliament sat, there was a bit of skullduggery, and the Country Party was convinced by the Labor Party to withdraw from the coalition. The governor then commissioned the leader of the United Australia Party, Sir Stanley Argyll, to form a government, which would have been a minority government. But as soon as the Parliament sat, the government was defeated on a confidence motion by the Country Party with Labor support. Geoffrey Blainey has described the governor as being so shocked by what had happened. I mean, these two parties had campaigned together as a coalition, won the election, and then one defects and joins the Labor Party and defeats the other in government. He was so stunned he didn't know what to do, and it took him a few days before he requested the leader of the Country Party, Albert Dunstan, to form a government. The governor only acted after he received in writing from the Labor Party a commitment to support the Country Party in government. So then the Country Party governed as a minority government with Labor support against the United Australia Party. Very bizarre things happened in Victoria at that time. Other difficulties have arisen for vice-regal representatives when premiers or prime ministers have died suddenly in office. For example, at the Commonwealth level, Lyons, Curtin and Holt all died in office, leaving the Governor-General with the dilemma of who to appoint prime minister until the relevant party could elect a new leader. This choice can be controversial if it's seen as giving an advantage to the person who intends to seek the leadership. And it's particularly difficult where you've got a coalition, where you've got a deputy prime minister who's head of another party, the minor party, and you've got a deputy leader of the leading party, and which one do you choose? So, for example, when Harold Holt died, the Governor-General appointed John McEwen, the leader of the National Party, to be the interim prime minister, rather than William McMahon, who was the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, pending an election for leadership of the Liberal Party. Sometimes a premier or a prime minister may also lose the support of his or her own cabinet or party. In November 1987, Joe Bjelke-Petersen tried to sack five ministers of his cabinet as he struggled to retain its support. He proposed resigning and then being recommissioned to form a new cabinet. So when a premier resigns, that automatically takes out all ministers, and then if you get recommissioned, then you have the right to completely reform your own cabinet. So he proposed doing this, but the governor warned him that he might not necessarily recommission Joe as premier if he didn't believe that he could form a government that would have been supported on the floor of the parliament. Bjelke-Petersen eventually advised the governor to sack three of the ministers, which he did. But then there was a change of leadership in the party. Bjelke-Petersen was voted out of leadership of his own party, but remained premier and said that he was entitled to remain premier until he was defeated on the floor of the House. Now, that would have led to all sorts of interesting problems, because a defeat on the floor of the House might well have led to an election, and there were concerns that a divided party would lead to the defeat of it. And so Joe took the view that his members would have to vote for him and not in a vote of no confidence against him on the floor of the parliament. Well, in the end, it was resolved politically. Joe himself was convinced to resign and not test it on the floor of the parliament, which is what occurred. More recently, in 2008, Maurice Yemma lost the support of his caucus. He resigned as premier and as leader of the party. But what would have happened if he'd resigned as Premier and then advised the governor to recommission him with a new cabinet? That would have led to a very interesting circumstance. Should the governor had done so and waited to see if Yemma was defeated on the floor of the Legislative Assembly, or should she have commissioned someone else who had the support of the party and therefore a majority on the floor of the parliament? Again, that would have been an excruciating dilemma, because if Yemma had been recommissioned as Premier and there had been a motion of no confidence in him as Premier moved in the parliament, if there had been a successful vote of no confidence in the government, that would have been a trigger for an early election. And I think in those circumstances, the Labor Party would not have wanted to go to an election. So they would have effectively have been compelled to vote in support of Yemma in the parliament or otherwise risk an early election, which they would have most likely lost. So there are all sorts of interesting constitutional permutations and combinations that could have happened in that circumstance, but they didn't, because Yemma decided not to involve his party in such controversy and he resigned. Similar dilemma arose in New South Wales in May 1927. Then it was Jack Lang in his earlier government, his first government, and he was having difficulty with the support of his own members, and he sought a dissolution. But the governor didn't believe that he actually had the support of his cabinet and insisted upon there being a full meeting of the Executive Council. When the governor read out the Executive Council minute to the full Executive Council, which was all the ministers, he asked them to vote individually as to whether they supported a dissolution or not. Jack Lang said yes, all his ministers said no. The governor then said, right, well, we're not having a dissolution, but he then advised Lang to resign. He then recommissioned Lang and said, I recommission you on the basis that you hold act in a caretaker capacity and then advise a dissolution. And that's what happened. And then, of course, Lang lost that election. Later, he was elected and then dismissed. He had a very controversial career. In the case of hung parliaments, leaders have sometimes advised the vice-regal representative to let them test their support on the floor of the lower house first before appointing someone else to govern. This occurred in 1968 in South Australia, where the balance of power was held by an independent who had announced that he was going to support the opposition. The governor agreed to wait until parliament was recalled to test confidence. The government was defeated on the assembly floor and the opposition leader was then appointed premier. Similarly, in Tasmania in 1989, after an election produced a hung parliament, the opposition parties reached an accord which would have given them a majority in the legislative assembly. The incumbent premier, Robin Gray, advised the governor that he should continue in office, forming a minority government until such time as the parliament met. The governor agreed, swore in the new Grey ministry. But as soon as parliament met, a constructive vote of no confidence in the government was passed. That means they not only voted no confidence, but they voted confidence in someone else, being the opposition leader, Michael Field. Once the governor was satisfied that Field could form a government, he told Grey of his conclusions, basically putting the pressure on Grey to resign. Grey then resigned and advised that Field be appointed premier. Now, this use of the legislature to resolve the question of whom to appoint as head of government is one way of limiting the circumstances in which a Republican head of state might face exercising discretion. This method has already been adopted in the Australian Capital Territory, here in Canberra, where the Assembly, rather than a vice-regal representative, determines who becomes Chief Minister. Section 40 of the ACT Self-Government Act states that at the first meeting of the Assembly after an election, the members shall choose one of their own to be Chief Minister. If there is a vacancy in the office of Chief Minister while the Assembly is not sitting, the presiding officer is required to call a sitting of the Assembly as soon as practicable so that a Chief Officer can be chosen. If a motion of no confidence is passed in the Chief Minister, then the Assembly must choose a new Chief Minister. This, in effect, demands no confidence motions that are constructive in nature. They give support to someone else to be Chief Minister. Interestingly, the British Institute for Public Policy Research, which proposed a written constitution for the United Kingdom and actually drafted one up, also suggested that the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom be elected by the House of Commons and then appointed by the monarch on the report of the Speaker advising the outcome of that election. So that would be one way in which it could be done. Failure to appoint a Prime Minister, according to that draft UK constitution, would amount to a trigger also for an early election if there were a fixed four-year term of Parliament, which is also what was advocated in that draft constitution. Such provisions ensure that the leader of the government is the person who holds the confidence of the lower house. If a similar provision were included in the Commonwealth Constitution, it would have the effect of ensuring that the identity of the Prime Minister was determined by the members of the House of Representatives rather than by party members. Now, that could have interesting ramifications, particularly if it was a minority government, because then members from other parties in the lower house could have influence in dictating which person who was a member of the largest or leading power party actually became Prime Minister, rather than that party alone. It would also have an effect upon political parties that preferred their leader to be chosen by the rank and file, by the grassroots membership, rather than parliamentary members themselves. So it would have an effect on that. A third consequence would be that clear-cut election results would not give rise to an immediate change of government. There would be a delay while counting was finalised before Parliament could be recalled to determine who the new Prime Minister was. Now, while there'd be some disadvantages in such a delay, and there'd also be a need for strong caretaker government conventions to apply in the interim period, there might also be some advantages from this. The United States does it. Their elections take place over 2 months before the formal change in administration, and it gives leaders time to catch their breath, to plan, to form a cabinet, to be briefed, to employ staff, to prepare for government, rather than rushing from that frantic election campaigning on one day to the next day, trying immediately to rush into government. So there may actually be some benefits in that delay. If such a provision were to be adopted, it would also be necessary to have a mechanism to ensure that Parliament can be summoned and recalled so that a change in Prime Minister could not be avoided by the incumbent Prime Minister delaying Parliament from meeting. At the moment, Section 5 of the Commonwealth Constitution places in the Governor-General's hands the power to appoint the times for holding sessions of Parliament. This power, of course, is normally exercised on the Prime Minister's advice. It also provides, however, that after any general election, the Parliament shall be summoned to meet not less than 30 days after the return of the writs. If the appointment of the Prime Minister were to be determined by the House of Representatives in the future, then it would be advisable to summon Parliament much earlier after the return of the writs and the election results have been decided. In the ACT, the Assembly is required to meet within 7 days of the results of a general election. Another critical issue is prorogation. Currently, Section 5 of the Constitution provides that the Governor-General may prorogue the Parliament. That means that it terminates all bills, stops all parliamentary business, and the Parliament has to be summoned anew to commence anew in order to operate again. There is no limit on the length of prorogation, except for the fact that Parliament must sit at least once every 12 months, so that prorogation could not validly exceed 12 months in duration. The Governor-General prorogues the Parliament on the advice of the Prime Minister. However, there may be a discretion in the Governor-General to refuse to prorogue the Parliament if the purpose of prorogation is the avoidance of a motion of no confidence. Now, this situation arose quite recently in Canada. The Conservative Party had formed a minority government with Stephen Harper as Prime Minister after the general election in October 2008. It introduced budgetary measures which none of the other parties were prepared to accept. The Liberal Party and the New Democratic Party reached an agreement to bring down the Conservative government by a vote of no confidence, with the intention of forming their own minority government, which would be supported on issues of confidence by the Bloc Québécois. On the 4th of December 2008, before Parliament was scheduled to meet, the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, asked the Governor-General to prorogue the Parliament until the 26th of January 2009. To this, she controversially agreed. It prevented Harper from facing a no-confidence motion in the interim. By the time that Parliament resumed in late January, the Liberal Party had a new leader. There were new budget measures proposed by the Conservative Party that satisfied the concerns of the Liberal Party, and Harper's Conservative government survived. Although Canadian commentators have claimed that there's no such precedent for these matters anywhere throughout the Commonwealth, they weren't looking very closely at Australia, where there have been a couple. In New South Wales in 1911, the McGowan Labor government lost its majority through the resignation of members. The acting premier, again William Holman, advised the lieutenant governor to prorogue the parliament until by-elections were held. The lieutenant governor refused to prorogue, and the government then resigned. The governor then called on the opposition leader, Charles Wade, and asked him to form a government. He agreed, but on the condition that he was granted a dissolution. This was also refused by the lieutenant governor, who then had to reinstate the previous Labor government and then prorogue parliament as originally advised. Probably not the best move overall. In October 1971, the Western Australian governor was faced with a similar dilemma. The Speaker of the Legislative Assembly had died, leaving a Labor government with 25 seats, the opposition with 25 seats, and once Labor appointed a Speaker, it would have been in minority. The opposition was threatening to hold a vote of no confidence in the hope of getting an early election. The Western Australian Premier, John Tonkin, advised the Governor, Sir Douglas Kendrew, to prorogue the Parliament until after the by-election was held. The governor did so, but then sought advice from the British Foreign Secretary as to whether he'd done the right thing or not. The Foreign Secretary said to the governor, well, it's within your powers, but I'm not telling you whether you did the right thing or not. So no advice on high as to whether he had, in fact, behaved correctly. If the appointment of the Prime Minister is to be determined by the House of Representatives rather than the head of state, then there needs to be a mechanism by which a majority of the House of Representatives can require its own recall from an adjournment or summons for a new session when the House is prorogued in order to deal with the issue of confidence in the Prime Minister. In the ACT, the Assembly has to meet within 7 days of a request by a specified number of members. Such a provision would need to be inserted in the Commonwealth Constitution if the head of state's discretion in this area were removed. Apart from these established reserve powers of the vice-regal representatives concerning appointments and dissolutions and dismissals, the real risk of a directly elected head of state with a perceived mandate is that he or she will exercise discretion with respect to other powers such as royal assent to bills, the command of the armed forces, decision as to whether to put a bill to referendum and the like. The late Professor George Winterton has rejected the notion that the power to give royal assent is a reserve power, although others have suggested that it may be. The main argument here is that the vice-regal representative, as the last bastion of constitutional protection, should be entitled to refuse assent to a bill that extended the life of the parliament or abolished the opposition or otherwise irreparably undermined the democratic system. Now, while this may be relevant in places where there is no entrenched constitution, such as the United Kingdom, it's not relevant at the Commonwealth level in Australia, where any attempt to change the term of parliament would require a referendum, and any legislation that breached the express or implied constitutional requirements of responsible or representative government would be held invalid by the courts. Ultimately, here there is another venue for determining those issues, and that is the courts. While there may still be arguments about whether a vice-regal representative should refuse assent to a bill if so advised by ministers, as opposed to acting solely on the advice of the two houses of parliament, there is no question as to whether he or she has a personal discretion to refuse assent simply because he or she objects to a bill. Section 58 of the Constitution currently states that when presented with a bill for assent, the Governor-General shall declare, according to his discretion, but subject to this Constitution, that he assents or withholds assent or reserves the bill for the Queen's pleasure. It would therefore be important to clarify in the Constitution that when a Republican head of state receives a bill for assent, he or she must act either on the advice of the two Houses of Parliament, with relevant variations for referendum bills and bills arising from joint sittings, etc., or upon ministerial advice, but that no personal discretion is involved. Section 58 also contains a clause that permits the Governor-General to return a bill to the Parliament, transmitting with it any amendment which he may recommend. Now, this is intended to accommodate circumstances in which an error is discovered in a bill so that it can be corrected before assent. By convention, this power is only ever exercised upon ministerial advice, but it would need to be made clear in a Republican constitution, lest a directly elected head of state started using it to suggest his or her own proposed amendments, which would be a potential risk. Finally, a provision ought to be included to make it clear that apart from the extremely rare circumstances in which reserve powers may be exercised, the head of state is obliged to act in all matters on the advice of his or her responsible ministers. Now, as you can no doubt tell from my opening, I'm not particularly in favour of a directly elected head of state. However, I am strongly of the view that if this is a likely outcome, then there is an obligation upon constitutional lawyers, such as myself, to contribute ideas to ensure that the best possible form for our future constitution is achieved. And in that spirit, today's address is part of my contribution to the forthcoming debate. Thank you.
We have a short time for questions. Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones? I think you've stunned them into silence. Haven't got too much time to think.
Thank you, Anne. And I particularly enjoyed all the examples of the use of the reserve powers at the state level, many of which I think certainly I was unaware, and many people are unaware of just how prevalent these exercises are. I had two questions. Firstly, with regard to altering the power of the Senate to block supply at the federal level, that deals with the issue of the potential for dismissing a government on that basis. But I wonder whether there's a different and perhaps even a better way, and that is to retain the power of the Senate to block supply but prevent any dismissal on that basis, which is the American system where you can have a blockage of supply and you have a political crisis, but without any potential for dismissal resulting from that. And that resolves itself as it does in the US through political means, but without having any even potential impact upon the powers of the upper house. And the second question comes to your endpoint where you talk about direct election. And I wonder whether you see your model of limiting the powers rather than full codification as being sufficient for a direct election model, whether you think that goes far enough to rein in, limit, circumscribe the powers of a directly elected head of state, or whether in fact you would need to go a bit further and deal with some of the residue that's left. I was just a little unclear as to whether you think this was it if we ended up with a debate of that kind.
Okay. Oh, no, they're good questions. Yes, you need to somehow deal with, if you've got fixed term elections, then you need somehow to deal with the issue of what happens if supply is blocked in the upper house. And as you say, the examples I was drawing from were existing examples in the states as to what happens, which is why I was referring to what happens in New South Wales and Victoria. South Australia, interestingly, does, as best I can tell, and it's a little bit strange in their constitution, but as best I can tell, still has the power for the upper house to block supply and does have a fixed 4-year term. And I was asking a South Australian colleague as to, you know, how then you deal with those sorts of potential problems with an upper house blocking supply and you know, whether that would lead to difficulties or not. I don't think that they've really ever sorted that out in South Australia, although I suspect that it might partly be resolved by those bills of special importance if you made your bill for the ordinary annual services of government a bill of special importance, then you can trigger an early election if the upper house blocks supply, if that's what you want to do. So that's another way of dealing with it. But I think you're right. You could just specifically have something in there saying that that the head of state can't dismiss Prime Minister on grounds of a failure to pass supply by the upper house and leave it to a political answer, a political conclusion, and by taking out that one element of risk in the game and both sides knowing that they really need to reach an agreement or otherwise they themselves will become unpopular once people are not receiving their paychecks, and that itself is another possible option. So, yeah, I think that's certainly another one on the table. As to whether all of this is sufficient or whether you need more, well, it was all I could think of. So it probably is, in my view, sufficient, although maybe if I sat and thought about it more, I might think of something else. I was just trying to add another perspective to the debate on this by drawing on what had already been done in state constitutions to add different ideas to the notion of full codification. I think it is very important, if you went the direct election route, to have a provision that makes clear that the constitutional provisions that could otherwise be seen as giving the head of state very broad powers in relation to the armed services and assent to bills and all those sorts of things. I mean, we know now that they are subject to convention, that they need to be acted on advice. But in the future, under a different constitution with a directly elected head of state who says, I've got a mandate, I've been elected by the people on this basis, those sorts of conventions could be seen to have been no longer relevant because we've got a new system. So you need to tie down those conventions one way or another, either by some form of codification, by saying, you know, you have to take advice on these points, or by removing the risk of discretion being used. Someone who I think was coming today pointed out to me that the couple of the other constitutions, the one of Trinidad and Tobago and the one of Jamaica, has a fair bit of codification of the reserve powers in it. And they do, and they're quite interesting to see. But even those constitutions where it's, you know, they allegedly completely codify do still have elements of discretion there. And I think you ultimately need some element of discretion underneath it all just to deal with bizarre emergencies that might happen in the future.
Thank you. How do they deal with the situation in Ireland?
Good question. Actually, the three constitutions that were raised with me were Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica and Ireland, and I read the first two and I didn't get much time to have a look at the third one, which was Ireland. Most unfortunate. It's the more obvious one. No, they did a fair bit of codification there too in Ireland. So there are, from recollection, there are provisions that expressly say that, you know, you have to act on advice in doing X, Y and Z. So, the idea is to remove the discretionary elements of their head of with respect to their head of state.
You could provide that the House of Reps can't be dissolved except on its own motion. Make them sort it out themselves. One last question. Now, sir, is this going to be a question or a speech? I insist on a brief question. Can you go to the microphone?
The basis of my question is in your papers on Parliament. The very first part says, is this a Scots or an English question? I was going to go much further. You were delightful in what you said about the Victorian part. I'm only asking to you answer that. Is this a Scots or an English question?
Well, I've got a question anyway.
It's one of the more interesting questions I've been asked, I have to say. In the United Kingdom, there are all sorts of fascinating issues with respect to devolution in relation to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And what's known as the English question there is whether England itself should have its own separate legislature, or whether the United Kingdom Parliament, when voting with respect to matters that concern English things like education and the like, where education issues have already been devolved in Scotland, whether Scottish members of Parliament who are in the, sorry, members of the United Kingdom Parliament who come from Scotland should be able to vote on English matters. Now, that would lead to all sorts of difficulties if they couldn't, because you've got a Scottish Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, who then wouldn't be able to vote on most of the things that his government does in England, which would cause all sorts of problems. So the United Kingdom has all sorts of interesting issues with regard to Scottish questions and English questions. Today, however, I was addressing Australian questions. But if you want to know more about the Scottish question and the English question and how it would fit into a similar type of written constitution, I'd recommend that book called A Written Constitution for the United Kingdom, which was published by the Institute for Public Policy Affairs in the United Kingdom, which does deal with all those issues as well, in a similar vein to the way I was describing them today.
Okay, unless someone has a very last brief question, very last one and very brief.
Well, I understood we were following the Westminster system, but it's nothing like it, is it? Why do we have so much government in this country? Why don't we get rid of the states and have bigger local government areas? It seems to me that that's a question should be looked at in this constitution entirely. What's your opinion about having less government?
But if you hadn't had the states, you wouldn't have all those interesting cases to throw on.
Well, that's actually quite true, because one of the benefits of federalism, as Harry's just pointed out, is that we can learn and see from examples, in this case constitutional examples of the states, when we're adopting things at the national level. And you look at things like fixed four-year terms and whatever, and you see them starting off in one parliament and people go to see how it works and, you know, which bits work and which bits don't, and then it moves over to, you know, to South Australia and to Victoria, and they do their own variations, and some people see, oh, the Victorians have actually done it better and maybe we should adopt their version. And that's one of the benefits of federalism. But to give you the longer answer, there's actually going to be a public debate on this in Sydney in May. It's being run by the IQ Squared organisation. It's their debate. And I'm actually one of the people in the debate. I'm on the side of retaining the states. So if you want it to come or listen, it's going to be held in Angel Place sometime in May.
Okay, on that stimulating note, let's thank our lecturer.